The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Armitstead.
As you can hear, a gust of Welsh hwyl blew through the festival with the arrival of singer Ceris Matthews for a session based on her new songbook, Hook, Line and Sinker. The Catatonia singer and broadcaster serenaded festival-goers before her event and battled with distinctly vocal babies during it to spread her own brand of happiness. She stopped off to tell us about her musical mission. So, Ceris, you've come straight from your proms debut last night to Edinburgh.
Yeah, and my head's still a bit spinning a little bit, I've got to admit, because for one, we didn't get back to the house till 3 a.m, because it was a late night proms. So we didn't get on stage till 11, and then the whole excitement of playing and playing that such iconic venue. And I chose to play some songs that are probably from the 7th, 8th century. Nobody will ever know really how old they are, but they're certainly old enough that King Henry V used to enjoy dancing with his convivial companions to them. They're from a very old book of mine that I was given by a friend called Jeff Towns, who's an antique book dealer. And just to bring these songs alive, to bring them back, you know, they were favourites of a royal, bring them to the Royal Albert Hall, and to play them to a very mixed, you know, music-hungry audience was just... Oh, it was just such an exciting feeling, and they loved it. They went down very well, you know. These deep Welsh rave records is what Steve Lamacq called it. I just love bringing these old tunes back alive, you know, seeing how the modern audience reacts.
So you've come to Edinburgh to talk about your book.
The whole point of this book isn't actually the book itself, but the actions the book encourages, which is essentially just to lose any sort of self-consciousness and just make noise, whatever that noise might be, whether it's close to singing or not, is kind of irrelevant, as well as unlocking a lot of memories, because that's the beauty of living. As you go through life, you'll collect favourite sounds and songs, and they with them come memories, and this book spans an awful lot of years. Certainly if you're anywhere near my age, you'll recognise some from the 70s, for instance, from Saturday morning TVs, like Tis Was, like the Tra La La song, or the Bucket of Water song. And then there's a chapter for older people, I guess. But there's World War One songs and Long Way to Tipperary. And
do you ever feel that this sort of a messianic campaign you're on to get people to sing, you might be sacrificing some of your own career to do this?
I never think in terms of career. I always move along with what's really exciting me. But I've always collected songs and I've always loved songbooks. I think at the moment it kind of makes sense, because at the minute, everywhere you go, you hear other people's recorded music. Whereas years ago, you used to make your own music a lot more. And I think the pleasure you get from making your own noise is something that we shouldn't lose, because it is just pure joy. You know, gadgets and iPads and phones and headphones are filling up our time. And so to just do things like home cooking, home music making, home grilling, barbecuing, lighting fires, you know, that's what I love doing as a sort of antidote to my other life, my modern life, you know.
How important are words in this?
Yeah, they come hand in hand. You know, in the Welsh language as well as the Somalian language and probably many other languages, the word for music is the same as the word for poetry, cerdd. You can get an excitement out of the sonics, the physical feeling of making noises, but then there's a story, the enjoyment of the rhymes in the songs, and then there's the history of the songs themselves, who wrote them, when they were written, why they were written, when they were written, And then there's the memories they unlock for you. So your history with that song. So it works on so many different levels.
So this book is actually a songbook. It's like an old-fashioned songbook, really, isn't it? Yep. Might you ever write a history of song yourself?
I am fascinated by the history of songs. I was talking at length with a musicologist yesterday when we were hanging around before the prom, and he was talking about a book that the anniversary is coming up. It's the 600th anniversary of a book of collected, again, Welsh songs, but it to me it's going to be Welsh, Canadian, you know, it's world songs I collect from all different cultures. So I am in close working relationship with Roy Sayre, who's a very well-respected musicologist from Wales as well, and he helped me with my notes on the Welsh album that I put together in 2010. But a whole book, at the moment, see, my mind's starting to work at another project, which is the centenary for Dylan Thomas, which is coming up next year. So that's my next project. Hannah Ellis's granddaughter has asked me to write at length about my uncle Colin Edwards, who was the guy in the 60s who realised the importance of Dylan Thomas and went round interviewing all the people that had come in contact with him, including family members and people he worked with, amateur dramatics clubs from when he was a student and in school. And it was from all of his archived interviews that they've pieced together anything about Dylan Thomas from in all the major biographies like Fitzgibbon. All of the dramas that are going to come out next year will all have plundered my uncle's archive. So I would like to really find out more about him. Sadly, he's no longer with us, so I can't ask him directly, you know, why Dylan Thomas, why this obsession, you know. But I'm going to ask surviving family members of my own to find out that story.
One of your themes is how important it is to sing together as families.
Yeah, I think because I enjoy singing so much, and with my, you know, growing up as a child, I've got a 10-year-old daughter, and she comes home from school, and has friends around, and I hear them singing in this transatlantic nasal noise because they're trying to emulate an autotuner on the radio. And my main thing for any sort of musician or anybody really walking the earth is you must find your own way on this earth, find your own voice, be confident in what you bring that's unique to you, you know, don't try and copy too much. Be inspired, but always find your own way, you know. So I guess it's something to do with that. But it also works in a simple way as well. It's got all the words in it, so you haven't any excuse to not sing, really, you know. And the great old family favourites in there, and from Songs for Babies all the way up to When We Hit the Grave, you know, it's essentially just to encourage people to enjoy singing, and also not just singing, but you know, get your one finger piano going again. And what I've loved hearing about people in sheltered accommodation or, you know, in homes that have brought out the book and have enjoyed it. And many teachers have got in touch saying how much they've enjoyed it and their pupils as well. So it's that kind of thing I love, as well as just families.
But he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes, he's got high apple pie in the sky. Hopes that time
you're getting lost, instead of letting go,
just remember that ant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree.
Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant.
The irrepressible Kerris Matthews. And now for something completely different. The novelist Jane Gardam, who was at the festival to talk about the final instalment of her Old Filth trilogy. It's set among an elderly group of international lawyers returned home to vegetate in Dorset. Last Friends begins with a challenge. All the central characters of the first two parts are dead.
So it made it rather difficult to make it seem interesting from the beginning for people who are wanting to read about what they've been reading already in the first two books. But there are plenty of takers to move in on them, you know.
So this gives an opportunity for two of the subsidiary characters to take centre stage, one of whom you describe memorably as somebody who is always destined to be in the background of the story.
We've had him around from the beginning, but just a mention here and there when he was a little boy in the northeast, very silent little boy. I just called his father Mr. Smith. The little boy I didn't even give a name to. Later I called him Fred, and then he became Fred Smith. And then he chose a very posh name for himself, Frederick Fiscal Smith. and in the end got a knighthood and was a top lawyer.
And the other character is Dulcie, who is wonderful. In fact, it's as if the whole novel is processed through Dulcie's mind. It's slightly wayward in the way that it's constructed and the way that you use language and you use recollection.
Yes, Dulcie is a very old-fashioned person. There can't be many left like her, I think, now. She always gives an impression. I remember my mother's friends of everything being absolutely delightful, my dear, you know, as long as we're in charge of the empire and the world, and everyone admires us so much. But they all loved her. It was quite extraordinary. She was the most lovable, enchanting woman.
And slowly a very dreadful creature called Fiscal Smith began to take charge in a way. I mean, he never became more than a background character. He always thought he was something. But in the end, I found he and a woman who's a very silly woman, you know, called Dulcie. She is a survivor too, and I found that it was very pleasant to have them as the last friends of this group of expatriates who'd been a lot in the Far East and who'd then settled in England and had made the mistake of settling somewhere where there was absolutely nothing to do. "How arrogant you are, Fiscal Smith," she said. "I simply put my case," he said, and that was when she made the great mistake, which none of us must ever make when someone says that. She said to her guest, "Your case is in your bedroom, Fiscal Smith. Do you want help with packing?" And there fell a silence as she stepped out upon the terrace with his cup of tea. Oh dear. He stood there for half an hour. Dulcie came walking past him towards the wrought iron gates. Fully dressed now in tweed, skirt and cardigan, remarkably high heels for her age, and some sort of casual coat, not warm, from the cupboard under the stairs. She carried a prayer book, po-faced. Fiscal Smith shouted, "Where are you going?" "I am going to church," said Dulcie. "Dulcie, it is 6 o'clock in the morning, it is clouding over, it is beginning to rain, that coat you had in Hong Kong, and it isn't Sunday." "I need to say my prayers," said Dulcie. "It will be locked." "I doubt it. The great Chloe is supposed to open it, but she usually forgets to shut and lock it the night before. Sometimes she locks in the morning and unlocks at night. We shall have to tell the church warden soon." "Actually, I think she may be the church warden." "There's nothing much going on in the church. Not even anybody sleeping rough. It's too damp." He was padding along beside her. "There you are," she said, "unlocked, unlocked all night." Inside, the church scowled at them and blew a blast of damp breath. Hassocks looked ready to sprout moss, and there was the hymn book smell. "Stay there," Dulcie ordered him, making for a chancel prayer desk up near the organ. "I can't pray with anyone watching." There was the sound of a heavy key being turned in the lock.
To what extent is this a novel about the end of empire? And we know that Sir Edward and Betty left Hong Kong in 1997, and that's the end of their empire. And I was intrigued by that, because I always thought of the end of empire as when India became independent.
Like Paul Scott's Staying On, which is a very powerful and, I think, wonderful book, wonderful account. It influenced me more than many others about India. I suppose I don't know much about the end of Hong Kong, except that we talked of nothing else while we were out there, of what it was going to be like. And I remember people saying, "Give it 5 years and all these buildings will have dirty marks trailing down them, just like they are in China." Of course, it's not true. They're more glittering and perfect than they ever were before.
There are quite a few memorial services in this book. In fact, they run through the trilogy because people keep dying. It's not at all gloomy. You managed somehow to tell these occasions, recount these occasions, with this huge impish, can I describe you as impish, humour?
Well, the Raj wasn't maudlin in any way, I don't think, especially about memorial services, which they loved. They all gathered together and met each other and talked of old times, and in a funny way, seemed hard as nails. I did start them with memorial services, but then we look back at the people who are dead and find them, I hope, more rounded. Funerals were very important to the Raj. They all turned up for the funerals and talked in those funny voices they all had. I had relatives and friends I love dearly. You couldn't sort of let them talk on the radio now about what they... I had a boyfriend who was a Cypriot, and my Aunt Kitty was appalling. She said, you do realise, don't you, that Britain rules the world. And, you know, there's nobody in this world that doesn't respect us. And I wanted to say, do be quiet, you're 100 years out.
The first novel was about Sir Edward Feathers, who's Old Filth, which stands for Failed in London, Try Hong Kong. Then the second one was told from the point of view of his wife, Betty. This one started out being from the point of view of Veneering, who is an altogether more louche character in a way.
Yes, that's the word. I wasn't quite sure whether I could cope with him. Veneering's very complex. I think he was perhaps too much for me, I don't know. Perhaps I got him wrong because he had to be blonde because his father was a Russian. He had to be immensely attractive. That was important. He also had to be very clever, that he'd hardly been to school. And he had to be irresistible to the wife of Old Filth, who was the catch of the world, you know, and a very good man, absolutely irreproachable, marvellous person. And you see, Veneering wasn't. I think Veneering had a very secret side to him. On the other hand, he was shocked, Veneering, by any kind of crime. I mean, when he found out that his son was rubbish, really, I'm afraid, enchanting rubbish, he could not bear it.
His father is a Cossack, and this is in Teesside.
Extremely unlikely, but in fact it was true. Because I saw the Cossacks dancing on Teesside when I was at school, I think. A great grey tent like a filthy-looking mushroom was put up beside the gasworks. And then Cossacks began to arrive. They were lanky, marvellous-looking men. Well, I'd never seen any dancing at all. We went every evening for a week. And I was told later, I'm afraid this was an illusion. You couldn't possibly have done. They would not have been in the northeast at that time, because our relationship with Russia was not such. I swore I had, and my little friend Mary said she had too, but no one believed us. And then I was having lunch with Margaret Drabble, who is also a Yorkshire girl. She comes from 20 miles up the coast, a place called Filey. She said, Jane, I saw those Cossacks dancing. And then where did they go? I don't know. That's what I'd love to know. What happened to those Cossacks? And were they spies? I mean, was there a chance that one of them might have been extremely powerful, interesting man?
I'm quite interested in the relationship between your fiction and history, historic events. And there's one particular event, which is the sinking of a ship full of refugee children who are on their way to Canada.
Well, you know, I think every single one of my books starts with the importance of childhood. You know, Dickens said, keep the child in view, always. He actually wrote that in the margin when he was writing about Little Nell. I know that when I look at people's faces, I seem to try and see them as children. You can do it with men, but not with women so easily. It's very strange.
Nevertheless, you spare. Veneering is about to go on this boat, and
oh,
one of the big plot mechanisms is that he jumps ship.
Yes.
And you send a rather sinister headmaster and his wife off on this doomed boat.
Yes. And I'm afraid I sent off all the children who, in fact, were drowned on that ship. It was the City of Benares, a most wonderful ship. It's a fairy tale, a horrible fairy tale, this story, because it was built in Benares, and it was sailors were all Indian, and they all treated the passengers as if they were princes, even the little ones, the little sir, and little sir they called them, and they wore white, and they had curled up toes and turbans, and the children who'd had nothing much to eat, 1939-40 England, where it was pretty grim, they walked on board a fairyland. There are stories of how they looked round and thought, you know, this is heaven. They didn't seem to miss home at all. They were all torpedoed and drowned 4 days later in the middle of the Atlantic, because the ships that were accompanying them were told to turn back. This ship would now be safe. A German U-boat saw her and sank her, and nearly 100 children drowned, and I think about under 20 survived. But the strange thing was, the ones who were picked up by the Royal Navy after 12 days in an open boat, nearly dead. And there were 12 survivors who were boys. And, you know, every one of those children went into the Royal Navy. My idea at the very beginning in this book was to write about the city of Benares, because it's only been written about as a sort of diary. But in fact, the subject is too terrible. Churchill stopped those ships straight away after that. There were no more. The one before it had been torpedoed anyway.
Now, you mentioned Dickens. I wondered the extent to which this novel is a homage to Dickens, because the sort of legal setup that you conjure is very Dickensian, and the names you use for the characters are very Dickensian.
Yes, they came to me. I mean, they just... Peter Parable, I thought, oh, that's all right, was it in Dickens? In fact, I think I made it up. Parable, Apse and Apse, I thought was Dickensian, yeah, but yes, he was at my shoulder all the time, saying, go on, write it, do it, go on.
The way that you write this book is very playful. At times it becomes a screenplay.
I don't see why not. I think it's time that novels were much more various and lively, and I don't see why we shouldn't start writing a bit of dialogue and drama in the middle of a novel. I've done it before. One or two other people have done it too, but there's no reason why. I mean, no one knows what a novel is anyway. The word novel is hopeless. They only call it novel because it was new. They couldn't think what else to call it. It's a very bad name. Just the short stories are pretty boring too. But novel is a bad name. It tells you nothing. And in fact, a novel should be, in my view, it should be sparkling and inventive and like the South Americans, perhaps.
Magic realism, almost.
Yes, almost. Well, yeah. I suppose so. One uses that phrase quite carefully, I think, because it's a bit technicolor, but yeah.
The very first sentence is "the Titans were gone" of this novel, and the very last word is "resurrection." And I wondered whether there's going to be a further resurrection of these characters, because there are lots of characters that you haven't explored. There's Isabel, who had an affair with old Filth, and there's, you know, you could do much more with Dulcie or with Fiscal Smith.
Well, I don't know about Dulcie. I think we've about said it with Dulcie. But the beginning of the three, I was fascinated by Isabel and wanted to, and thought there'll be more, I can do much more with this. It'll be... But it didn't happen. I'm sort of shy. I think she's lesbian, and I'm just sort of shy of that aspect of things in those days. Also, she was wildly and passionately in love with this boy. She's very interesting, actually, a woman like that. And then at the very end, I have her sleeping in the old boy's house after the memorial service, all by herself on his bed without sheets on it. A very old woman by this time. Still very beautiful. Yes, one could do all kinds of things, but haven't we had enough? I mean, haven't I said all there is to say?
Have you?
I'd like to try, yes, I would.
Jane Gardam. Well, apart from consorting with novelists, aficionados of the book's website will know that we've spent part of the festival soliciting favourite words from visiting authors. You can see and hear them all on video in our live blog. But Julia Donaldson and her husband Malcolm went one stage better. They volunteered to sing us their very own word song, Snittlegarth Stroll.
Let's go to Snittlegarth and pick some squinancy words. Do let us do. Never mind the cuckoo spit, we're off to little snoring for a faggot or two. Next stop, Paddle Dock, roll your galley gaskins up, we'll stick in the mud. Hut foot to Frogbury, cross fingers there to see the toad flax in bud. Sitting side by side on the ha-ha at Giggleswick, we'll laugh at our woes. Through High Egborough, Herringwell and Garlic Street, just follow your nose. On to Nether Wallop for a roam or pound, a game or two of Mumblety Peg. The sows here at Stuckeridge will water us with whortleberry ale by the keg. Pad fiddle in the keekle, and I'll sniggle you a pickerel to pickle with dill. Through carefully, carefully, perching willy-nilly on the pillion to pill. Clod, hop, to rattery, we'll turkey tuck till Saturday if you're in the mood. We can see the tumuli beneath the sky of cumuli, so on with your snood. Down a temple guiting, they're humbling the barley and a jouncing the hay. High as to pitting hope, perturbing the ptarmigan, we'll wamble all day. Off to Buttock's booth for sooth, for chitterlings and flummery and stargazing pie. We'll play tiddlywinks in Totterdown, shove halfpenny in Shillingsworth, just you and I. Ring the tintinnabulum, we'll ogle on the ottoman at Thurrock and Throop.
You in your frippery,
you in your Burberry, will dawdle in droop. Holes in your Wellingtons, you won't feel forlorn for long, a furlong to trudge.
Till we're back to bed in Birmingham, underneath the eiderdown with Barnaby Rudge.
The Books Podcast from Guardian.co.uk.